Lecture 24, Pax Romana.
Hello and welcome to the last in our series of lectures on Alexander the Great and the Hellenistic Age. In the final lectures in this series, we've been looking at the gradual encroachment of Roman power into the Eastern Mediterranean. And we've seen that originally the Romans were little interested in the affairs of the Greek world, being rather more preoccupied with first the domination of the Italian peninsula and then their conflicts with the great superpower of the Western Mediterranean, namely Carthage. But we've also seen that gradually, as a result of the alliance between Hannibal and Philip V of Macedon during the Second Punic War, that the Romans were gradually brought into the eastern orbit of affairs. And I argued that if we examined closely Rome's involvement here, both during the First Macedonian War at the end of the 3rd century and in the Second Macedonian War, when they were finally and completely victorious over Philip's army at Caena Scaephalae, that if we examined these events and this period, we'd be able to see that the Romans really demonstrated no long-term plan for a conquest of the Hellenistic world or the Eastern Mediterranean. And I remarked that in 196 at the Isthmus of Corinth, the Romans issued a proclamation. It came from the Senate, and it was in the name of the Senate and of Titus Quintius Flamininus, declaring the Greeks to be free, the freedom of the Greeks, to live without Roman garrisons or anyone else's, to live without tribute, taxes paid to any overlord, and to live according to whatever laws they chose to for each of their own separate states. And I strongly suggested that this was not merely the political rhetoric of the age, though it is true that a phrase like the freedom of the Greeks had been bandied about by earlier so-called liberators, but I argued that in this case the Romans remained true to their word, and that the final proof of this was that 2 years after these events, the Roman troops were gone from Greece. They had given up the three great garrisons known as the fetters of Greece. They had not attempted to annex any territory. No Roman provincial governors had been sent out. And in fact, the Romans had remained true to their word. Now, in the next 50 years, there would be a dramatic shift in the attitude of the Romans towards their allies and their enemies in the Eastern Mediterranean. And that 50-year period would set the stage for the final century of the BC era, the final century of Roman expansion into the Eastern Mediterranean, which would see the defeat of Macedon, the defeat of the Seleucid dynasty in Syria, with Rome, however, becoming more and more preoccupied with its own civil conflicts, and the Hellenistic East serving then finally as the backdrop both for the culmination of Rome's civil wars and Rome's conquest of the Hellenistic East. The two stories are utterly intertwined and cannot be separated. Anthony's alliance with Cleopatra, so well known to us from Shakespeare, Cleopatra, his Hellenistic queen, raised the prospect at the very end of Hellenistic independence of a Roman Hellenistic hegemony over the Eastern Mediterranean. But that would pass into history with their defeat at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, a victory for Octavian, soon to be known as Augustus, whose power would extend over the entire Mediterranean, both west and east, witnessing the final collapse of the Hellenistic kingdoms and the beginning of a more profound Hellenization of the Roman Empire. So it's a complex and convoluted story that we want to try and chart in our last lecture. In the aftermath of the Roman declaration of the freedom of the Greeks, the Romans found that their former allies, the Aetolians, resented the failure of the Romans to reward them. And so it was that in the late 190s, Roman legions were once again in northern Greece. But now they were dealing with Aetolians who were unsure whether they were friends or enemies of the Romans. There is one episode that we have recorded in this period that I think tells us a great deal about the way in which two cultures, in this case the Greeks and the Romans, could look at each other, could speak to each other, and could totally misunderstand what the other side was saying. These events occur in 191 BC, and at this moment an Aetolian embassy is talking to a Roman general named Valerius. And in the typical fashion of the Hellenistic period, these Aetolian ambassadors start waxing long and lyrical about the long contact between their two countries and the great previous services that the Aetolians had done to Rome. Valerius cut this line of argument short by saying that such justification did not apply to the present circumstances, for as these old friendly relations had been broken off by the Aetolians, and the existing hostility was owing entirely to the Aetolians themselves, the services of the past could be of no assistance to them in the present. Typically Roman brusque, uninterested in any of the folderol of Greek diplomatic language. They must therefore abandon all idea of justification, adopt a tone of supplication, and beseech the consul's pardon for their transgressions. After a long discussion on various details, the Aetolians eventually decided to leave the whole matter to Achilleus, and to commit themselves without reserve to the good faith of the Romans. Now, what follows is Polybius' comment on this episode and the decision of the Aetolians, written by someone who understood the Greeks and understood the Romans, and this is what he has to say. Remember, they've committed themselves without reserve to the good faith of the Romans. They had no comprehension of what was really involved, but they were misled by the word faith into supposing that the Romans would thereby be more inclined to grant them terms. But with the Romans, for a man to, quote, commit himself to their good faith, unquote, is held to be equivalent to surrendering unconditionally. So just as at the beginning of this course of lectures we saw the Greeks and the Persians misunderstanding each other, so too now we find at the end of the Hellenistic period the Romans and the Greeks utterly misunderstanding each other. As a result of this misunderstanding, the Romans looked on as the Aetolians appealed now to a new liberator of the Greeks, in this case Antiochus III, the king of Syria. And Antiochus duly therefore proclaimed that he was coming to liberate the Greeks once again. The Greeks must have got very tired finally of all these liberations. Antiochus' invasion of Greece in 191 BC precipitated the first Syrian war, the war between the Romans and Antiochus of Syria from 191 to 188 BC. Now, this war is an interesting one for us to pause and consider for a moment. Unlike earlier conflicts with, say, the Carthaginians, with Hannibal, or even with Philip V, there was no natural enmity here, no history of conflict between Antiochus and the Romans, no clash of economic interests, as there may possibly have been in Spain between the Romans and the Carthaginians. There were not even strategic interests involving the two of them, because Antiochus's whole sphere of influence, the Eastern Mediterranean, was outside of Rome's sphere of influence. So why do they go to war? Antiochus had hosted Hannibal after his defeat. Hannibal eventually died at the court of Antiochus. But this was hardly a cause for war in the eyes of the Romans. The Romans had already demonstrated that they were uninterested in annexing Greek territory. Instead, the war resulted from the increasing entanglement of the Romans in the shifting and unsteady alliances that existed throughout the Hellenistic world. By now, the Romans were allies of Eumenes, the king of Pergamum. And it is that alliance, I think, that accounts for their decision to come east again. And of course, Roman generals may have looked upon this as another opportunity to win glory and booty. But still the Senate demonstrated no desire to acquire more territory. Antiochus was defeated at the Battle of Thermopylae by Lucius Cornelius Scipio, brother of the man who had defeated Hannibal. The great military commanders even come from the same families. And Antiochus's army withdrew to Asia Minor, where the Romans pursued him, and as we know, they defeated him at the Battle of Magnesia in 189 BC, a battle that we've mentioned on a number of occasions in this series. You'll recall also that the Peace of Apamea, which was signed the following year in 188, dramatically altered the geopolitical map of the Eastern Mediterranean. We've looked at this from the point of view of the Seleucid monarchy on a number of occasions. Now we have to consider it from the Roman angle. The Romans collected a massive amount of booty, including an indemnity of 10,000 talents from Antiochus, crippling the Seleucid kingdom as it was forced to pay this off over the next decade. And we've seen also that Antiochus was forced to cede virtually the entire western portion of his empire, the region known as Asia Minor, corresponding to much of western modern-day Turkey. But did the Romans establish now a province? Still, the answer is no. The Romans granted all of this territory cut off from their enemy to their allies, Eumenes of Pergamum and the people of Rhodes. So even now, down into the 180s, even though the Romans have been brought east once again, thanks to their alliances with various Greek states and Hellenistic kings, they still demonstrate a willingness to fight wars, but no desire to actually annex territory. They are not seeking an empire at all. But there was to be a change of heart. A change of heart in the ruling class of Rome in relation to this business of eastern campaigns, territorial annexation, and the administration of foreign territory. And it began in the generation following the defeat of Antiochus III in 189 BC. The Senate now would come to be persuaded that military solutions were not long-lasting. Defeat one of these kings once, and you would still be called back a year or a decade later in yet another war involving them. The events that I think precipitated this change of thinking and a change of policy on the part of the Roman Senate occurred between 171 and 168 BC during the Third Macedonian War. In 179 BC, Philip V of Macedon had been succeeded by his son Perseus. Perseus was concerned with restoring the prestige of Macedon and its influence in Greece. And during the course of that decade of the 170s, Perseus had fought a series of campaigns in Greece and was denounced constantly, year after year, by Eumenes II, the king of Pergamum, who feared the threat to his own kingdom of Pergamum if Macedon once again grew powerful. So you have to imagine a situation where the Romans, year after year, are hearing these denunciations. You must do something about Perseus. The Romans accepted the charges laid against Perseus by Eumenes and finally dispatched an army to Greece. And in the fourth season of the war between Perseus and his Macedonian army and the Roman legions, the Romans were successful in bringing him to battle at Pydna. And in 168 BC, at the Battle of Pydna, the Macedonian phalanx was wiped out. Perseus was captured. He was sent to Rome. He was paraded in chains in the triumph of the victor Lucius Aemilius Paulus. But this is the most important point, not the humiliation of a Macedonian king. Macedon was partitioned into four separate republics, and the kingship was abolished. This is one of the first instances of the Romans stepping in and changing the actual constitutional arrangement of a territory that they've now conquered in war. And gradually, after the partitioning of Macedon, it's possible, I believe, to detect a hardening in the Roman attitude towards this endless cycle of internecine fighting between the Greeks and the Hellenistic kingdoms. And so we find that in the coming years, the Romans simply lose patience and now begin to act much more decisively. So, in 148, a fresh revolt breaks out in Macedon, and this time, when the revolt of a certain Andriscus has been put down, the Roman victor, Quintus Caecilius Metellus, disbands all forms of autonomous government in Macedon, and Macedon becomes a Roman province, ruled directly by a Roman governor. This, I think, comes about as the result of the exasperation of the Romans with the people of Macedon and the Greek world. Now, of course, as Roman attitudes towards the Greeks are changing, as they're becoming more exasperated, so too the Greek attitude towards the Romans is beginning to change as they turn sour on their Roman liberators. In 196, the Romans had been hailed as liberators. People had cheered so much at the Isthmus of Corinth that they'd forced Flamininus to read the decree a second time. But now, 50 years later, they're denounced as hypocrites. And as a result, one final war of resistance flares up, organized in the Peloponnese by the members of the Achaean League in 146 BC. And the Roman response to this is very instructive. The war finishes not merely with a Roman victory in the field against a Macedonian phalanx or a Greek army. The war ends with the sack of Corinth, one of the oldest and most prestigious cities in the Greek world, leveled to the ground. later to be rebuilt, in fact, as a Roman colony. And perhaps even more dramatically, in this year, 146, is really one of the great turning points in European history. In this very same year, the Romans also face a final conflict with their old enemies in the Western Mediterranean, the Carthaginians, who have raised the battle standard once again. And that war also finishes with the sack of the city. So I think we've got here a Rome which is dramatically marking its position in the world of the Mediterranean very differently from the way it has behaved in the century beforehand. Because with the sack of Corinth in the east and the sack of Carthage in the west, the Romans really mark their conquest of the Mediterranean, leaving only Syria and Egypt of the old great Hellenistic kingdom still independent, and some smaller states around the edges of this. The emergence of Rome as the single power of the whole of the Mediterranean now coincides then with the annexation of Greece, and with the defeat of the Greeks in 146 and the sack of Corinth in that year, Greece, like Macedon now, is annexed and it is turned into a Roman province. Thereafter, from 146 onwards, it is not even known as Greece any longer. It is called the Roman province of Achaia. And this phenomenal growth of Roman power and its assertion of its domination over both East and West also corresponds at the same time with a century of instability in the older Hellenistic kingdoms. So if we want to think in terms of Tyche or fortune, as the people of the Hellenistic age would think, Rome's Tyche is in the ascendant while that of the Hellenistic states is declining. New kingdoms were sprouting up on the edges of the disintegrating older Hellenistic empires, kingdoms such as Pontus up on the Black Sea, Bithynia, a little west of that, and Cyrenaica, west of the Ptolemaic domain in Egypt. And the kings of these domains, very interesting, they're local potentates asserting their independence, but what do they call themselves? In their titulature, they are now philoramoios, that is to say, they are lovers of the Romans. They're declaring themselves to be allied to Rome because they recognize now in the latter half of the 2nd century BC that Rome is the one superpower left in the Mediterranean world. This is dramatically illustrated by an event in 165 when the king of Bithynia, a man called Prusias, comes before the Roman Senate. But rather than wearing the robes of a Hellenistic monarch, he comes in dressed as a suppliant with chains on, as if he is a slave of the Romans. Rome's position in the East gradually solidified as a result of a series of extraordinary episodes, and I doubt that the Romans could have had much control over this. This is where the hand of fortune is working on their behalf. In 133 BC, when Attalus III of Pergamum died, and Pergamum by now, you'll recall, is a kingdom that embraces all of Asia Minor, He dies and bequeaths the entire thing to Rome, creating in one blow the Roman province of Asia Minor. So between about 150 and about 130, Rome has acquired Macedon, Greece and Turkey, to use modern terminology, and these are now all Roman provinces, Macedon, Achaia and Asia Minor. Similarly, in 96 BC, Cyrenaica, the area around Cyrene on the north coast of Africa, on the Libyan coast, this also was passed to Rome as a bequest by its last king. And then finally, the habit seems to have taken off. In 75 BC, the kingdom of Bithynia up on the Black Sea also passed to Rome on the death of its king, Nicomedes IV. So the older kingdoms are being replaced or broken up with like mice nibbling away at the edges, and these smaller independent kingdoms allying themselves to Rome actually become part of the Roman domain as their powerful kings die and bequeath them to Rome. And then what about in the older Hellenistic kingdoms, the main ones of Syria and Egypt? Well, Roman expansion into the east is being aided here by the weakness of the Seleucids in Syria. The kingdom had lost its western holdings to Rome in 188 and to Pergamum as well, and now it was further buffeted by a change. In the east, the part of the eastern satrapies of the old kingdom, the rise of Parthia in Mesopotamia and Persia cost the Seleucids their eastern provinces. So we're ending up with only a rump state involving just really the region of Syria, bounded by Pergamum and Asia Minor to the north, bounded by the Parthians to the east, bounded by desert and by Judea to the south. And of course, as we know in Judea, the Maccabean rebellion eventually results in the founding of an independent dynasty, the Hasmonean kingdom in Judea. And then within the very heartland, just that area of Syria, Coele Syria as the Greeks call it, or Hollow Syria, in that very area too, the dynasty is rent by dissension between rival claimants, weakening therefore the power of the kingdom. In Egypt, a similar story. The Ptolemies come under increasing Roman influence during the 1st century BC. One of the weakest of the Ptolemies, Ptolemy the 12th, Ptolemy Auletes, Ptolemy the flute player as he's called, required the intervention of a Roman army in order to secure his throne. And Roman officers become advisors at the court of Ptolemy, and they become officials serving in the upper echelons of the Ptolemaic bureaucracy. So there is a way in which Ptolemaic Egypt is almost being sucked into Rome's orbit, and Roman officials are almost taking over the running of the state. The last of the Ptolemies, of course, was Cleopatra. Cleopatra the VII, the famous lover of Caesar and of Mark Antony. And we'll talk a little more in a moment about her career. But I suggest that we have to remember that it has to be seen against the backdrop of Rome's final annexation of the East. Cleopatra was fighting a rearguard action. She is the last Hellenistic ruler trying to find some way to salvage the power of the Hellenistic East in the face of an inexorable advance of Roman power. Now, we've looked at affairs in the Hellenistic East during this period, but we need to backtrack for a moment because the story is also driven by the internal affairs of Rome, and the two will eventually come together. But the strand we need to follow for a moment is that of the history of Rome between about 100 BC and 31 BC. Even as the Eastern Hellenistic kingdoms are getting weaker and weaker, Rome is experiencing a succession of supreme commanders who are willing to use overseas campaigns as the basis for establishing their own power at Rome. Men like Marius and men like Sulla, who fight overseas campaigns in order to win greater glory and to then assert that control of Rome. During the 60s BC, Pompey asserted Roman military might throughout the eastern Mediterranean. So it is he who really finally represents the power of Rome sweeping away the last vestiges of independence in the eastern Mediterranean. He sweeps out pirates from the Aegean in 67. And the fact that a Roman supreme commander had to be given that job, I think, gives us some idea of how endemic piracy had been in the eastern Mediterranean. And between 66 BC and 62 BC, he established a network of provinces and client kingdoms across the east that acted as either allies of Rome or buffer states between Rome and the people further beyond, such as the Parthians to the east. So the entire east is being incorporated into the Roman provincial structure, but it is not done smoothly because Pompey is for a time allied to and then an enemy of Julius Caesar. And the civil war that is going to be fought between them and the last rounds of civil war that afflict the Roman Republic will not be fought only in Italy, but will be fought across the Mediterranean and particularly in the eastern Mediterranean. So the Hellenistic world is finally going to become the backdrop for Roman civil wars. The civil war between the armies of Pompey and Caesar was fought primarily, in Greece. And after his defeat there, in the Battle of Pharsalus, Pompey fled to Alexandria, where he was killed. Caesar followed Pompey to Egypt, only to arrive and find that his opponent had been slain. And then Caesar stayed on, involving himself in the internal affairs of Egypt, first helping Cleopatra to keep her throne, and then fighting a war against the Alexandrian mob through much of 47, one of the toughest campaigns of his career ever. And during the course of this time, as he was there helping the young Egyptian queen to establish her authority, he also, as we know, had an affair with her, and Cleopatra bore a son whom she named Ptolemy Caesar. And the very last phase of the connection between the Hellenistic East and Rome would come about once again as a result of the civil wars of the Romans and Cleopatra's position in Egypt. After Caesar's assassination in 44 BC, a final round of civil war broke out, involving Mark Antony, who had been Caesar's right-hand man, and Caesar's heir, Octavian. Now, for some time, they managed to partition the Mediterranean between them, with Octavian campaigning largely in the west, and with Mark Antony campaigning largely in the east, with Egypt as his base of operations. There, he, like his old friend Caesar, fell in love with Cleopatra, and the two of them together had three children, a royal family, if you will, with each of their children being given a nominal kingdom in the Hellenistic East. But after pacifying the western provinces of the empire, Caesar's heir Octavian finally marched east to confront his one remaining enemy, Antony, a man who by now had almost completely given up the manners of a Roman general and was behaving as a Hellenistic king. He and Cleopatra together held sumptuous banquets. He's sometimes referred to as the last prince of the East. And at the Battle of Actium, off the western coast of Greece, in 31 BC, Antony and Cleopatra were defeated. They fled to Alexandria, and with their suicide, the last remaining Hellenistic monarch from the blood of Ptolemy, namely Cleopatra, died. Egypt was annexed and became thereafter a Roman province. And so by 31 BC, the Hellenistic world is now entirely a subset of the Roman Empire. Well, it would be wrong, I think, to finish our series of lectures on the Hellenistic Age by concentrating only on the political demise of the Hellenistic East, because it is important to remember that Rome really, by now, had become thoroughly a Hellenistic empire. The great poets of Hellenistic culture, men such as Catullus and Tibullus and Ovid, were writing poetry in Latin but using the meters of Greek poetry, regarding the Greeks as their masters. And so Virgil, who produced the finest epic ever produced in Latin poetry, can really be seen as a Latin inflection, if you will, of Greek epic. The epic that he writes, that of the Aeneid, is a poem that's produced during the reign of Augustus, the man who finally incorporated all of the Hellenistic East into the Roman Empire. And it is a poem which is, in a sense, a national celebration of Rome's genius. There is a moment in the Aeneid when Virgil will have one of his characters turn to Aeneas and say, "This Roman will be your genius. Debellare superbos et pacere subjectis," to throw down the proud and to spare the conquered. And in that one line, we get a more perfect expression of Rome's imperial mission than anywhere else in Latin literature. And yet, the Aeneid, though the national epic in honor of Aeneas, the founder hero of Rome, is essentially a work that could not have been made possible had it not been for Greek epic before it. Because the whole first half of the Aeneid, which tells the story of Aeneas' arrival in Italy after his journey from Troy, is essentially modeled on the Odyssey. And the entire second half of the work, accounting for the foundation of his dynasty, which eventually will give Rome its kings and the glory of Rome, is essentially modeled on the story of the Iliad. And so it is with Virgil, I think, that we get a perfect expression of the great irony of the Hellenistic world. That a world which passed into history in the realm of politics and lost its independence by 31 BC would nevertheless live on as a culture influencing first the Romans and later the rest of Western European civilization. The more we look at the Hellenistic world, In conclusion, it seems to me, the more we find an age that continues to exert subtle but strong influences on our own age.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit our website at www.teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.